8 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call the first meeting of the Committee on Taxes for the 2019 session to order, and we do have a quorum. I'm State Representative Paul Marquardt, and I want to say good morning to everyone, and also what an honor it is to be able to serve the state and serve the Minnesota State Representatives in the capacity as chair of this committee. And I have to say that I have had some excellent mentor chairs as I have served on this committee with Chair Abrams, Chair Krenke, Chair Lincheski, and Chair Davids. I have been under those four chairs, and I hope I can be as fair and courteous as those chairs were. So, Chair Davids, thank you for your lead. And I really look forward. This is a committee that can really make a difference in people's lives, as we know. So I'm looking forward to the work that we have before us. So before we start, I'd like to go with introductions. And so if I could just ask members just their names and then where they represent, some counties and towns and so forth. And I'm going to start with Chair Davids, if you could start.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Greg Davis, representing District 28B, which is all of Fillmore and all of Houston counties. I border Iowa and Wisconsin, so I'm way down there in the corner. And Chair Marquardt, I just want to congratulate you on your chairmanship. Just so everyone here knows, it is the best committee ever developed or devised.
Thank you, Representative Davids. I'm going to come up here with Vice Chair Les Lagarde, and then we'll go around the room. So if you'd introduce
yourself. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Dave Les Lagarde, representing 6B, and that's most of St. Louis County and the Iron Range. So it truly is a pleasure. I look forward to working with the whole committee and working underneath you, Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Brand.
Good morning. My name is Representative Jeff Brand. I represent Mankato, St. Peter, so Nicola County, a little bit of Lassure County, a little bit of Blueworth County. Thank you. Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris Wazinski. I represent House District 16A, which is Lacaparl County, Yellow Medicine County, a good chunk of Lyon County, and a sliver of Redwood County. So I'm a defense against South Dakota at times, and sometimes we lose.
And welcome back to the committee, Representative Wazinski. Welcome back. Representative McDonald.
Good morning. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald from District 29A, which is the Wright County. So a lot of my friends and family say I'm in the Wright County. Anyway, a pleasure to be back on the committee here. It's been, the last 4 years I served, and it is by far one of my favorite committees. I think Representative, the former chair, was actually correct. It is one of the best committees to be on, especially if one has been on the Health and Human Services for the last 8 years. God bless you. Anyway, a pleasure to be here back again.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm Dan Fabian. I represent District 1A, which is all of Roseau, Kitson, Marshall, and part of Pennington County. And I tell people that I also represent the southern part of Manitoba and the eastern part of North Dakota, just to give you a reference for where I am. I do want to caution folks that if you talk about northern Minnesota, just understand that we consider Bemidji to be in central Minnesota where I live. So, okay, thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations on your chairmanship.
Thank you.
I'm representative of District 24A, which is the cities of Old Town of Waseca and the townships in between. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair. Good to have two Red River Valley people here, you and I. Sandra Erickson, I represent 15A, and that's in east central Minnesota, all of Mille Lacs County, part of Kennebec, and part of Sherburne, great part of the state.
Thank you very much. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Schumacher, I represent the southwest corner of the state, bordering South Dakota and Iowa. And, Mr. Chair, I have to apologize for being 3 minutes late. Our committee lead has already scolded me thoroughly for that, so it won't happen again.
Very good. Thank you very much. So we'll start over here. Representative Sean.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Tu Zhang. I'm from 53A, the East Metro area, the cities of Maplewood, Oakdale, Woodbury, and Landfall. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
I'm Jen Schultz. I represent District 7A, which is East Duluth, and I'm happy to be returning to the Tax Committee, but I disagree with Representative McDonald. Health and Human Services Finance is also a great committee and a very important committee. I know that everyone's favorite city is Duluth, so hopefully you will get there often.
I'm Lyndon Carlson, and it's good to be back on the Tax Committee. I was first on the Tax Committee in 1973. former Chair Abrams, during a meeting, commented that he was the longest-serving member of the Tax Committee, and I said, gee, I didn't think he went back to 1973. But the truth of that is that I did have to choose. At a point there, I was appointed Chair of the Education Division of Appropriations, and it happened to meet at the same time taxes did, so I did take a leave of absence for a number of years from the Tax Committee, but now I've had another pretty long run, and it's a good committee to be on. I'll think about whether it's the best committee or not. I've been in the Chair of Ways and Means currently.
And our Property Tax Chair, Representative Loeffler.
Good morning. I'm Diane Loeffler, and I represent District 60A, which is 15 neighborhoods of northeast and northern southeast Minneapolis. And I'm delighted to be back on the Tax Committee. We have some important work to do. And Chair Marquardt always makes it fascinating and easy to understand.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Jamie Becker Finn, District 42B. I live in Roseville. I represent parts of Roseville and Shoreview and also the cities of Venice Heights, Little Canada, and Gem Lake. And I was the committee legislative assistant on taxes 12 years ago, so it's good to be back, and this time I can actually ask questions, so that's great.
Under Chair Lincheski, is that right? Representative Becker Finn under Chair Lincheski?
Yes, under Chair Lincheski's first year chairing the Tax Committee. Yeah. So it's nice to see some familiar staff faces as well. So,
thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. John Lesh, I represent District 66B. That's in St. Paul, the neighborhoods of Como Park, the North End, Hamlet Midway, and the East Side. And this is my eighth term on the Tax Committee, and it's been exciting every year, Mr. Chair. But I would ask this, Representative Carlson, 1973, could you smoke in this committee back then?
Representative Carlson.
I will answer that by saying I was elected, Mr. Chairman, the same year that Representative Phyllis Kahn was, and so if you know her history on smoking, you can probably guess what the new rules were.
Yeah, well, I get it.
Representative Carlson.
Martin Sable, Speaker of the House at the time, was a heavy smoker, as was Ed Burdick, believe it or not. Huh? And Representative Kahn made a motion to amend the rules to bar smoking on the House floor. And the compromise was to exempt the front desk. And she did that as a freshman legislator. And then she came back, I think the following biennium, and expanded it to include the ban on the front desk as well. So the speaker and the chief clerk would have to go to the retiring room at that point. But at any rate, things were tightened up through the years relative to the smoking, Representative Lesh.
Well, thank Representative. You, Chair. It's too bad because I may need a cigarette at some point on this committee, but at least you can still drink.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Lean. I'm a fourth-term member from District 4A, so that is Moorhead and Oakport Township. And Representative Erickson, there are a couple of us Red River Valley legislators here. No worries. Thank you.
So, and Representative Fabian, you spelt your Red River Valley.
Kind of,
yes, that district a little bit. So, and
yeah, but I'm the heart of the valley, like those two.
And I don't think I mentioned I'm District 4B and also Red River Valley, and representing all or parts of Clay, Norman, and Becker County. And Representative Erickson, you were a teacher in Hillsboro. Is that correct? Or
yeah,
where were
no,
you?
I grew up.
You grew up in Hillsboro.
But I was born in Ada.
Oh, and that is in my district.
Yes, it is.
Yes, very good. Lots of connections here. So, well, welcome, everyone, and thank you for serving on the Taxes Committee. At this time, I'd like to introduce staff that, of course, are the group of people who really do so much fantastic work and make us look so good, as best as we can most of the time. So with that, what I'd like you to do is just, as I kind of introduce you, if you would say basically what your duties are. And so, Ms. Griska.
I'm Ursula Griska, and I basically do anything administrative that has to do with the committee, assist Nathan here as well, so I do minutes. I prepare for the meetings.
All right. Mr. Jessen.
Hi, I'm Nathan Jessen, committee administrator, so I'll be helping the committee set up times, make sure we have everything we need for committee, and assisting the chair in every way I can.
Very good, and I know we have partisan research and staff, so Mr. Rubis?
Steve Rubis. My job is to help get the minority back to the majority.
So, and so, Mr. Rubis, if you would sit a little further back. So, thank you very much, and appreciated working with you the last few years, too. And Mr. Houdan? Mr. Haydorn, thank you, yes. And so now we have, also before we go on, we have the legislative liaison from the Department of Revenue, Leslie Thompson.
I'm Leslie Thompson, and I'm from the Department of Revenue. If you need any resources at Revenue, you can come to me and I can help connect you.
Very good, thank you. And House Research Staff, Ms. Dalton.
I'm Pat Dalton. I have not been here as long as Representative Carlson. I've only been working for 33 years staffing this committee, and I do sales taxes and some of the local government aid programs.
Mr. Klayman.
I'm Chris Klayman. This is my fifth session, and this session I'll be handling corporate and business taxes, income taxes, also insurance taxes, estate taxes, and a few other random issues. I also do liquor regulation, which is, of course, in a different committee, but...
Very good. And one member of fiscal staff, Ms. Schill.
Hi, I'm Kathy Schill. I do property taxes and work with Representative Loeffler in the division.
Mr. Swanson.
I'm Jared Swanson with House Research. I work primarily in property taxes.
Ms. Hagler.
Hi, I'm Alex Hagler. I'm the newest analyst in House Research, and I will primarily be doing property tax, but also be doing the charitable gambling tax, liquor, and cigarettes.
Very good. Ms. Templin.
Hi, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I've been with the Tax Committee since 2006, and I do state taxes, mainly state taxes and no profit.
And Mr. Williams.
I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I work primarily on income tax modeling, and property tax refund program.
Thank you very much. And we have two pages. They're temporary, although they may wind up permanent. But Amanda and Thomas, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Thomas DeGallier. I'm originally from Winona, Minnesota. I was here for the latter part of last session, so I'm good
to be
here.
And I'm Ben Chevel. I live in St. Paul now, grew up in St. Cloud, and I'm excited to be here as well.
Thank you very much. So this is the tax team, everyone here. And so before we go further and before we... Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, everyone. My name is Aisha Gomez. I'm the newly elected representative from District 62B, which is the south side of Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have four first-time legislators on the committee, which I think might be somewhat unusual, and maybe Representative Carlson and Representative Davids can allude to that, first-termers, and then a total of 10 members who are new, first-time on the committee. So that's good. Lots of good, fresh ideas. So if you would at this time take a look at the committee procedures. And I'm not going to call them rules because in taxes we don't have rules. But there are some procedures, and just a couple I want to make note of. And I know Representative O'Neill has a committee, also another committee meeting at this time. So she has already checked in. And so that brings up a great point that if you cannot make it, you are excused. That's it. You're excused. If you can notify staff that you're going to be gone, that would be great, but it's not required. So you will be excused. Also, when it comes to amendments, there is no 24-hour rule, but all I ask is that you keep the staff in mind when you're doing that. So, and when we go especially to do the mark up the omnibus bill and so forth, there's no, you know, you can bring things in, but just be cognizant of the work that the staff has to do. Also, members, if you have a bill up and you have testifiers that are going to be coming from any distance, notify us so we can accommodate that. Now, the fact that we meet at 8, if folks come from your district, Representative Fabian, they're going to have to come from the the night before, more than likely.
The day before.
3 days before. But at any rate, we want to be very, you know, amenable to that and making sure that they, you know, we work around their schedule so we can work around bills and things like that. So just want to make sure you have that. So that's pretty much the rules. And so, you know, some of the things goal-wise that I'm looking at is that I'm hoping we can create a tax bill that works for everyone everywhere. And one of the main things that we can do in a tax code is to make it more accountable, more transparent, and more results-driven. Because I think a goal of this committee should be that every person should know as they're paying their tax dollars, where those dollars are going, and also what type of value they're getting for those dollars. So every dollar they put into the system, they should know that they're getting a safer, healthier, stronger, better educated communities. And I think that should be a goal of this community, of this committee, is to try to make things as accountable and transparent as possible. And one of the first things we're going to be doing as a committee, and I've talked with Chair Davids about this, is going to be a citizen tax comment line, which means, and it won't be, they won't call in, but we're looking at doing this on the website of the Taxes Committee, where people can call in, excuse me, they can write in and talk about how to make the tax system more accountable, more transparent, and any other ideas they have regarding taxes, and especially as we do conformity in that. So hopefully, you know, bringing comments from their house to the Minnesota House, you know, from their kitchen table to the committee table. And so when we're going to try to get some publicity out on that, and so we're going to be getting information out as we do that to all the members. But I think it's a good way to really kind of focus on the accountability and the transparency of what we do here in the Tax Committee. So looking forward to a great year and putting together an excellent bill that can really benefit people around this state. So with that, I think we're ready for presentations. And members, as we go on, feel free to ask questions. Would that be okay, Mr. Williams, Ms. Templin, if we ask questions as you go on? Because sometimes things get lost, and once if you continue and we wait for it. So, members, if you have a question as this presentation is going on, just feel free to do that. Oh, looking ahead, I'm going to do that now rather than the end of the meeting here, is tomorrow we'll continue with overviews. And then next week, on Tuesday, we're going to do an overview on the tax conformity and those items. And we will do that on Tuesday and run into Wednesday. But for stakeholders, on Wednesday, we're going to open this up for testimony. And I know many of you already testified last year on tax conformity. But it would also give you a chance for 2 or 3 minutes to kind of introduce yourself to before the committee. So next Wednesday, stakeholders, we will open that up to testimony. And it can be on the tax conformity, but also if you just want to talk a little bit about your organization, you can do that then, and with the key being 2 to 3 minutes. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just asked Ms. Dalton if we had a new copy of this book. I don't know if you use this. It's the Minnesota Government in Brief book, which I take to all my meetings and town halls, and it's a great reference. And she just notified me that we are no longer printing this book. So if you use this book, maybe we can make requests to print it again. It's a really great resource for all your committees.
So, thank you. Ms. Dalton, what happened there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we like to take a look at everything that we are doing and see whether they are actually being used. The sense we had gotten, there hadn't been a really high demand for this, but I will carry back to our director that there are some people who find it very useful.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe people just really didn't know about it, because I kind of found it by accident, and then I found how useful it was. So it would be great. It's a great resource for all our new members and current members.
Yeah, good point, Representative Schultz. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My predecessor in my office left kind of a bunch of stuff. Among it was this little book, and I found it, like, so helpful to be able to dig into it, just because it had this – it has an overview of all of the budgets for the different departments, and so I, like – asked my LA, I was like, are we getting a new copy of this? So just to second Representative Schultz, saying how useful it is, you can report that there are at least two legislators that use it, please. Thank you.
And we have one more. Representative Becker-Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To get back to the schedule for next week, when we take testimony from stakeholders, will we also be taking testimony from the public as well?
Representative Beckerman, yes, if anyone.
Okay, have a constituent that is passionate about tax issues, they would also be welcome to have their 2 to 3 minutes.
It's open to anyone. Stakeholders, which would include the public.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So we have one more introduction, and Representative Joaquin.
I am so very sorry, Chair, for being late. And I am not from the Red River Valley, but I might have gotten here faster if I was. I was listening to you in the car, so I heard all the introductions. The Southwest Metro traffic is, I'm still trying to find that perfect window. So I'm Representative Cheryl Joaquin. I represent all of Hopkins and half of St. Louis Park. And I'm very, very excited to be on the committee. Thank you.
Very good. And just one more item on the schedule. Next Thursday, we'll have Commissioner Bowerly in to talk about the filing. And so if you've got questions on any of that and how that's working, that's next Thursday. Very good. So who is going to start? Ms. Templin, please proceed. And thank you.
Mr. Chair. Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal again.
Ms. Templin, the mic isn't on, or you're going to have to speak a little closer, I think. Okay. So just speak a little closer. Thank you.
You should all have the PowerPoint, a copy of the PowerPoint in front of you. Is this working? No? I'll talk. How about this? That's better.
Yes.
Okay.
We were in this room yesterday, and you've really got to get close, especially on that mic, I think.
Maybe she can. Is there another mic that works better?
Turn the volume up a little bit.
Okay.
That's better.
Oh, very good. Okay. Thank you.
You should have a paper copy of the PowerPoint in front of you, as well as it's on the screens above. And we have about 70 slides. So some of these slides, I know on my portion, I'll go sort of rapidly. But if you have any questions or if you need me to slow down, please let me know. Starting out on slide 2 of the presentation, you can see a high-level overview of state tax revenues in Minnesota. And this is to all funds. You can see there's $26.2 billion, and this is projected for fiscal year 2019. And I guess one of the key observations about this slide is that it shows that individual income tax and sales tax represent about 70% of total state tax revenues. Slide 3 is pretty much the same information, except it's the same information is showed in dollars. And you can see, again, individual income tax is projected to raise $12.3 billion in fiscal 19. So that was just a quick snapshot of state tax revenues, total state tax revenues for fiscal 19. And I want to just quickly go over fiscal resources, the tools that we have in this committee that we will be using during this session. One of the tools we'll use is a revenue estimate, and I didn't bring a copy because soon enough you'll have your desk will be filled with various revenue estimates for bills. Tax bills that change tax legislation are analyzed in revenue estimates, and the revenue estimates will show the change in state tax revenues. All revenue estimates are prepared by the Minnesota Department of Revenue in their Tax Research Division, and revenue estimates are prepared for all the bills. And if you have draft legislation, tax legislation, we can also have confidential revenue estimates prepared for bills. What else do I want to say about that? Now, you probably have heard fiscal notes. Most other finance committees use fiscal notes. In the tax committee, we don't use that tool very often, but sometimes members use the term fiscal notes and revenue estimates interchangeably. They're not the same. They're very different. I'm not going to dwell on it, but the fiscal notes are different. And I know that there's a brown bag session on fiscal notes to talk about how to request those, and that's a different process. But just again, the fiscal revenue estimates will be used in the tax committee. There are also local impact notes that can be requested. I believe it's through the chair or a ranking minority member. Local impact notes provide the impact at the local level, like for counties and for school districts. And there's a criteria for MMB that they evaluate various requests for local impact notes. We don't see a lot of those generated during the session. There are a lot of requests, but because there is a criteria for evaluating when a local impact note is actually produced and prepared by MMB, we see a few of them during the session. And then finally, tracking sheets. I just want to talk quickly about that. You do not have a copy of a tracking sheet before you. Tracking sheets are spreadsheets that show the revenues and the expenditures for the tax committee. And soon enough, you'll see them at the end of the session that show what the House committee has prepared as a policy package tracking the dollars and the revenue changes proposed by the House. And then we will also show that for the governor and compare the budget to the governor and then to the Senate. My colleague Kathy and I, we always say that the tax committee has one of the kind of the notoriously the most complicated spreadsheets. It's almost as bad as human services. It's long, and we'll try to make that as easy as possible to read. We struggle with that every year. And if you ever have any questions or suggestions about the spreadsheet and how to make it easier to read, please let us know. So moving on now, back to state tax revenues. Individual income tax, that, as we all know, is collected through withholding and estimated payments and final payments. Returns for the tax year are filed following the close of the tax year, and as you know, tax day is April 15th for this year, 2019. It's coming up. Although, with the federal shutdown, it should be interesting to see how that works. Individual income tax, as I said earlier, and consistent with the other slide, $12.2 billion is projected for fiscal 2019, and that is approximately 47% of total state tax revenue, and all of the revenue does go to the general fund. following along on slide 7. This is a kind of 10-year snapshot of individual income tax in nominal dollars and inflation-adjusted dollars. And you can see in 2009 in nominal dollars, income tax raised about $7 billion. And now in 2019, income tax raises $12.3 billion. Now, over that 10-year span, there have been a lot of state legislative changes, and some of those changes Mr. Williams will talk about in the coming slides. Now, slide 8 is the start of a few tax incident slides. Data for the tax incident slides comes from the Tax Incidence Study. This is a report that is published by the Minnesota Department of Revenue every 2 years, and the next report is expected to be published in about 3 months, in March 2019. The Tax Incidence Report displays the population of Minnesota households divided into 10 equal-sized groups of households ranked by household income. As you can see, the first decile shows households with the lowest income. Oh, let me just back up and say that so the tax incidence report shows the tax incidence in deciles, but for this presentation we have collapsed the data to show it in deciles, just so that it's easier to see on the slide, but it's the same information. And so you can see the first decile on your slide, the first quintile, excuse me, is shows income, household income, starting at $18,218 and under. And this what we want to show you here is that this slide shows the distribution of the tax burden by income for income levels. When we talk about burden, one measure used by economists is to look at the effective tax rates. Effective tax rates are the ratio of taxes paid relative to household income. So throughout this presentation, you'll be seeing a handful of tax incident slides. And one observation about this effective rate tax slide to note is just how far the bar for each tax goes out in the x-axis. So the highest income quintile pays the largest share of income taxes relative to household income. So you can see in this slide, the fifth quintile pays a 5.9% effective tax rate. And the top 1% pays a 7.7% effective tax rate. So you can see that this structure, this slide shows a progressive structure of taxation. The lowest quintile you can see shows a negative burden, and that is due to refundable income taxes.
This template, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair. So that's only for that first quintile income tax. It doesn't take other reimbursements through other areas. It's only from a renter's credit or any of those, that's not wound up into that or something like that.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, I believe it's just the refundable income taxes.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, do you happen to have, I was looking ahead, a slide telling us how many Minnesotans are in each of the quintiles?
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, I do not have a slide for that, but it's something I can look up and get back to you later.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since other tax benefits like renter's credit and homestead credit and those sorts of things came up, I think that first quintile, if I'm, and Michelle, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that also includes businesses that have losses, so that their income might, you know, that are go through pass-through as an ordinary income. Is that correct?
Ms. Templin.
To the extent it's in individual income taxes, it would be picked up, but I should also preface this that this report, typically the department, you know, when they come in with the next report in March 2019, they, if they come and do a presentation, they will be able to provide additional detail, you know, and for those types of questions and provide kind of their methodology as well. But back to Representative Loeffler's questions, you know, if an individual income tax, if a pass-through is paying individual income taxes, then it would be picked up in this slide.
Thank you.
All right, please continue.
Okay. Slide 9, you can see this slide is a little different. This shows who pays the tax. Again, this slide comes from the tax incidence report, and this slide shows the distribution of who pays income taxes by quintile. Who pays is a calculation of taxes paid by quintile relative to total income taxes. So when looking at this slide, all the bars you see to the right of the quintiles should add up to 100%. You'll see that the fifth quintile pays the largest share of total income taxes at 75.5%. Again, this is consistent with the last slide on effective tax rates that showed that the income tax was a progressive tax, and that the higher the income, the higher the share of income tax paid. And moving on, the individual income taxes, Mr. Williams will do the following slides.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I'm going to talk first about sort of how the income tax is calculated. So at a very high level, the taxpayer's tax is calculated by taking the tax base times the tax rate. That gives you that taxpayer's preliminary tax. And then you would subtract off any tax credit that the taxpayer pays, and that equals the final tax that they would pay. So throughout the presentation, or this section of the presentation, I'm going to talk a little bit about, in the context of the income tax, what policy choices you as legislators have to make. So at a very high level, you can choose what tax base you want to allow or to use for calculating tax. You can choose what tax rates to apply to that tax base. And then you can choose what credits to allow. So that sort of lets you change policy at each of the different levels in the calculation I just described. So Minnesota's tax base under current law is defined as federal taxable income, which is a calculation done on the federal tax return. And I'm going to describe that in a little bit more detail next, plus Minnesota additions, and then minus Minnesota subtractions. So federal taxable income at the federal level is calculated as federal adjusted gross income minus either the standard or itemized deductions and minus personal and dependent exemptions. And I think that this is a little bit easier to think of visually, so I'm just going to sort of skip to the next slide. So this is sort of a diagram of how the tax system works. So a taxpayer first calculates their gross income. That's essentially all income that they earn. Then they would subtract adjustments, which are also sometimes called above-the-line deductions. That gets them adjusted gross income, or sometimes called FAGI, federal adjusted gross income. From there, you would subtract either standard or itemized deductions, and then personal and dependent, you used to subtract personal and dependent exemptions, and then that gets you federal taxable income. So for Minnesota purposes, that is sort of the starting point of our tax. So you can see that the federal tax sort of separates from the Minnesota tax at that point. They apply their tax rates and their tax brackets, and then they also apply their own non-refundable and refundable credits. And I think that one thing this demonstrates is that federal tax changes sort of after that point of separation don't affect Minnesota tax. So if the federal government changes tax rates, that doesn't really affect our tax, even though we use federal taxable income as our starting point. If the federal government changes credits, unless we've sort of defined our credits
as sort of a portion of the federal credits, that would also not change our tax. So in the calculation, you take federal taxable income, that's sort of the first line on the Minnesota tax form. You would subtract Minnesota subtractions and then add Minnesota additions, and I'm going to talk a little bit more detail about what sorts of additions and subtractions are allowed. That gets you the preliminary Minnesota tax, and then you would apply credits, and that sort of gets you your tax after credits. One other thing, I think that this is a useful place.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. For some of those Minnesota tax credits, are they subject to taxation at the federal level and vice versa? Some of the federal tax credits, are they subject to state taxation?
Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, so the federal tax credits are not, you can't deduct your federal taxes on your state tax return, although that used to be the case in Minnesota. And so the federal tax credits don't really affect Minnesota tax liability. A portion of your state taxes are deductible on your federal tax return. And so effectively, the 2017 Tax Act that Congress signed into law limited the amount of state taxes that you could deduct, but presuming that you're under sort of that limit on state taxes you could deduct, the federal government would effectively then be taxing the credits that we allow, if that makes sense.
Very good. Mr. Williams.
I think this is also a useful time to talk about a little bit of terminology. So I think that there's a term that gets used pretty generally, which is deduction, which is just a way that you're subtracting a certain item from income. But really, there's sort of three different kinds of deductions that are in this flow charts, and they're sort of used interchangeably, and it might be useful to distinguish between them. So the first are above-the-line deductions, or on the tax form, they're called adjustments to income. Above-the-line deductions are allowed to any taxpayer sort of regardless of whether or not the taxpayer itemizes their deductions or claims the standard deduction. And so those deductions, because they're sort of above the point of separation from the federal tax code, those do affect Minnesota tax liability. And then there's itemized deductions. So those are things like mortgage interest, charitable contributions, a portion of your state or local taxes paid. And those are calculated sort of after adjusted gross income. And those are only available to people who do not claim the standard deduction. So you sort of get the choice between itemized deductions and the standard deductions. And the third term that's on here is subtractions. That's sort of a term of art that we use in Minnesota to describe what are the sort of deductions we allow. But because our tax code has sort of picked up from the federal tax code after the application of either the standard or itemized deductions, Minnesota subtractions are available to all taxpayers, sort of regardless of whether they itemize. So some of the choices that you have, and this is obviously a big one in the upcoming legislative session, is whether or not to conform to using federal taxable income as the starting point for our tax. So as of tax year 2019, only five states, including Minnesota, use federal taxable income as the starting point. Vermont used to and actually changed that last year, so that number is decreasing. And all of the 2018 omnibus tax bills propose moving to federal adjusted gross income as the starting point for our tax. So that's sort of a policy choice that you'll need to make as a committee. You also have the option or the decision to make about what additions to require. So maybe you don't like some of these federal tax deductions, and so you would say in Minnesota, we're going to add that back. You could also have the choice about what subtractions to allow. So maybe you think something should not be taxed, and you'd like to add a Minnesota tax subtraction for that to sort of subtract that from income. Some tax subtractions are required by federal law, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail next. But, you know, there's a fair amount of policy discretion on the state tax to decide to, you know, allow subtractions for other items, depending on your preference. One other point that I think this is a good time to talk about is that, so Minnesota is a static date conformity state. What that means is in some states, if the federal government changes the federal tax code, that change is sort of automatically incorporated into the state tax code. But in Minnesota, we conform to the federal tax code as of a certain date. So essentially, we adopt all of the terms, some of the calculations in the federal tax code. And in Minnesota right now, we are conformed to the Internal Revenue Code as amended through December 16th, 2016. So that's a year prior to the large tax act that passed in 2017. commonly called the Tax Cuts and Job Act. And I'm going to talk about this very briefly right now because we have a whole presentation on it next week, but it's probably helpful to mention that the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act sort of fundamentally changed the composition of both taxable income and adjusted gross income. So some of the big changes, many of the individual provisions sort of expire at the end of tax year 2025, but that act repealed some above-the-line anitemized deductions or limited some of them. It increased the standard deduction. It repealed personal independent exemptions. There's numerous changes that passed through businesses, and then also it changed the measure of inflation that was used in for the purposes of the tax code. So those are some of the major changes that were sort of enacted as part of that act. And part of the challenge that I think the commissioner will talk about next week is that our tax code is linked up to the federal tax code as of 2016. But the federal tax code has kind of moved on. So on one level, very little has changed for Minnesota because we're sort of acting as if that law didn't ever get enacted. But on another level, for the purposes of filing, we're going to have to do a bunch of math to sort of get back to the old tax code. And that's sort of what complicates the filing process.
Mr. Williams, and I know we're going to cover this next week, but just for members, regarding the standard deduction and the personal and the independent exemptions, could you go over the major changes there and how that impacts current Minnesota law of starting at federal taxable income and why all the bills last year kind of looked at the federal adjusted gross income as a starting point rather than a federal taxable income? Just the difference, I mean, how big of a difference it was what the federal government did on standard deduction and the personal and dependent exemptions.
Mr. Chair and members, so I don't have the numbers memorized for 19, but for last year, under old law, for tax year 18 under old law, the standard deduction for a married couple filing a joint return was going to be about $13,000, and the federal tax, TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, increased that to about $24,000. So there's a pretty significant increase in the standard deduction amount. And then sort of a related change is it repealed personal independent exemptions. And so in 2018, that was another sort of $4,150 for each member of your household. So sort of the combined amount of the standard deduction and then personal exemptions under old law was about it's about a little over $21,000. And that got bumped up to $24,000. So the standard deduction amount went up quite a bit. And also, prior to the TCJA, sort of a family size adjustment was kind of baked into federal taxable income. So if you look at the flow chart going back a couple of slides, prior to getting to Minnesota tax, you were subtracting off dependent exemptions. So the amount of income that was subject to tax would decrease if you had a lot of dependents. And that was something we just sort of relied on the federal tax code to provide. But after, if we were to sort of just adopt all the changes under TCJA and make no other changes, we would not have any sort of family size adjustment like that in Minnesota. And so some of the challenges, I guess, I would say that the large increase in the standard deduction, but also taking away the family size adjustment, sort of makes it hard to pay for. I would say the large increase in the standard deduction just by conforming and retaining FTI, but also you would have to find some sort of way, alternate mechanism to replace the family size adjustment. So I hope that gets at what you were what you're asking.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Williams.
So I'll touch on this briefly. In addition to TCJA, there's actually two other federal laws that have passed. There's a Federal Disaster Relief Act and in March of last year, an act called the Bipartisan Budget Act that also put Minnesota out of conformity. So there's a couple of other, there's three total laws that have passed since that December 16th, 2016 date. So, conforming ideally would sort of simplify compliance for taxpayers, and it would be easier for the Department of Revenue to administer for the reasons I mentioned earlier, because we're kind of going through backflips on our tax form to sort of get back to the tax code as it was in 2016. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the additions and subtractions that are currently allowed in Minnesota's tax code. So we add back interest on other states' bond and any other bonds because we can't tax that, and then federal changes that we don't conform to. So if there's deductions or any provisions we don't want to adopt from the federal code, we typically add that back on the state level. In terms of subtractions, there are certain subtractions that are required by federal law. So by law, we cannot tax U.S. bond interest, we cannot tax railroad retirement earnings, and we cannot tax on-reservation earnings by members of Indian tribes. So those are three categories that are required to be subtracted. We also subtract some items that are sort of timing issues. And so essentially, we have not fully conformed to certain deductions at the federal level. So we kind of add back a portion of those in the current tax year and then subtract them out in future tax years. So examples of that are Section 179 expensing, bonus depreciation, and then rules regarding net operating losses. So those are sort of items where we are not in conformity, and we have made sort of an active choice not to conform to changes to federal taxable income. We also sort of have what we're calling here state discretionary items, another number of things that we've chosen, and this is actually just a sample of the bigger ones, but we sort of allow a portion of taxable Social Security benefits to be subtracted at the state level. Certain K through 12 education expenses. We allow a separate subtraction for charitable contributions. So as I mentioned earlier, charitable contributions are an itemized deduction. So at the federal level, you only get to deduct your charitable contributions if you're itemizing your taxes. But we have a separate charitable contribution subtraction for people who are non-itemizers at the state level. We allow a subtraction for a portion of your contributions to a college savings plan. We have subtractions for certain kinds of military pay and military retirement pay. We allow a subtraction for elderly individuals, and it's particularly targeted towards people that don't have a lot of Social Security income. We allow a subtraction for organ donation expenses, the education awards that you earn through AmeriCorps, and then interest earned that's put in first-time homebuyer savings accounts. Our current tax rates are displayed on this slide, as well as sort of the brackets for married joint filers in 2019. As you can see, the rates range from 5.35% in the first tier to 9.85% on the fourth tier.
And Mr. Williams, those brackets are indexed each year?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. So those increase every year, and those numbers are the tax year 2019 numbers.
Thank you.
So in addition to sort of having state discretion over tax subtractions that I mentioned, we also have the discretion to establish credits for state income tax purposes. So we have 11 non-refundable credits and 8 refundable credits. The difference between the two is non-refundable credits are only available to the extent of the taxpayer's tax liability. So if you have a $500 credit and you only pay $400 in tax, then you only get a $400 credit if the credit is non-refundable. Refundable credits offset liability, but they also pay the excess back to the taxpayer's refund. So in the example I gave, if you have a $500 credit and $400 of tax liability, you get $100 back as a tax refund. And sort of, it's those refundable credits that Ms. Templin was talking about earlier in that sort of create a negative tax burden for the first quintile of taxpayers. So I don't think I need to go into these in elaborate detail, but I think it's worth kind of brushing over each of these credits and I can answer questions. The other thing I wanted to note is that in your packets we have a sort of a pretty detailed overview document that provides a lot more kind of detail on some of these policy items. So a lot of these tax credits are covered in starting on page 12 or so. So we offer a credit for taxes paid to another state. So if Minnesota residents who pay taxes to another state, this sort of avoids double taxing income that is taxed by another state. And that's something that we're constitutionally required to provide. So the courts have ruled that we have to offer that kind of a credit. We offer a marriage credit that essentially reduces the marriage penalty for people who file a joint return. We offer a student loan credit that was enacted in 2017. The maximum credit is about $500 per person for that one, and it phases out with income.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, on the At what level does the student loan credit phase out? You have in the notation here it phases out. So what? And does the do you get the full 500 up to a certain point, and then it begins to phase out, and the 500 is reduced? Just how does that work,
Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's kind of confusing because there's not an income threshold at which it phases out. You essentially take your student, it phases out as a function of the amount of adjusted gross income that you have over, I think, $10,000. And so theoretically, if you had very high student loan payments, your credit amount would phase out at a much higher income level. So it's sort of the point at which it phases out depends upon how much of your sort of both your income level and also how much you're paying in student loan payments. So it's it varies quite a bit. And I haven't seen preliminary data on sort of where on the income spectrum that credit is falling right now. But I can maybe follow up with you after committee. I can give you, I have a spreadsheet that sort of calculates examples, and that might be a good way to sort of play and get a sense of how the credit works.
Mr. Chairman, maybe at least I'd like a little more information on that. You know, we keep hearing an awful lot in the media and from students about student debt, and I'd like to, at least as one individual on the committee, learn more about that credit and just how it works.
Very good. And I think it's a good time, too, also in the packets, is an overview of income, corporate franchise, sales, and other state taxes in a lot more detail that kind of explains some of the credits and so forth a little more, which can be helpful too. So, very good. So, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair and members, briefly, we also have a research and development credit that's based on the federal research and development credit. It's available to both C corporations and pass throughs, and the amounts for both are mentioned there briefly. We have a credit for long-term care insurance premiums. That's a maximum credit of about $200, and it's for 25% of long-term care insurance premiums. We offer a credit in addition to the subtraction for contributions to Section 529 college savings plans. That credit phases out at about $130,000 of income, or it begins to fully phase out there. So. And that credit is, the maximum credit is about $500. There's a new credit that is effective for the current tax year, so it hasn't really gone into effect yet, and that's a credit for sales of agricultural assets to a beginning farmer. We offer a credit for past military service, and that's primarily targeted towards sort of lower income veterans with a military pension or service-connected disability. So you have to have income below $37,500 to qualify for that credit, and the maximum credit is $750. We also offer a non-refundable credit for beginning farmers to sort of engage in certain continuing education programs. That's also effective for tax year 19, so it's just now kind of coming online. The maximum credit there is about $1,500, and you can claim it for up to 3 years. And I should note that the 529 college savings credit both of the beginning farmer credits were enacted as part of the 2017 tax bill, so those are pretty new. We offer a credit for employer transit passes. That is equal to 30% of the cost of providing those passes to employees. And then we offer a credit for teachers completing a master's degree in a core content area. That's a credit you can claim for $2,500, and you can only claim it one time. The refundable credits we offer, and these are maybe this is obvious, but these are sorted by size. So the largest refundable credit is the working family credit. It's effectively a state kind of equivalent to the federal earned income credit, although it's not necessarily tied to the federal earned income amounts. It's paid to lower income families, and it goes about 95% of the credit goes to families with children. The maximum credit for tax year 2019 is $2,156. We also have a historic structure rehabilitation credit that's tied to the federal credit, and that's incentive to sort of rehabilitate historic structures. It's mostly claimed against the corporate income tax, and it's also, if you qualify for this credit, you can also take it as a grant in lieu of credit. We additionally offer a child and dependent care credit. That is, the amount of that credit is tied to the federal credit. You can claim about $2,100 if you have two or more dependents, and it's phased out for married couples with income above $76,000 or so. We offer a credit for K-12 education expenses. It's for about 75% of certain expenses. That one phases out at about $37,500 for families with two children, and the maximum credit is $1,000 per child. We offer a refundable credit for taxes paid to Wisconsin. This is sort of, so the credit I mentioned earlier for taxes paid to another state is a non-refundable credit. This sort of replicates for Minnesota residents the benefits of engaging in a tax reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin. And the credit is only in place if no tax reciprocity agreement has been signed or agreed to with Wisconsin. So that's currently in effect. We have a credit for parents of stillborn children. So that credit is sort of intended to sort of replicate the effects of the federal dependent exemption. The maximum credit is $2,000, and that one was part of the 2017. Actually, that was enacted as part of the 2016 Omnibus Supplemental Budget Bill. We have a refundable credit for military service in a combat zone. It's $120 a month, and the size of that sort of varies depending on the number of people that are deployed in combat zones. And then we have an enterprise zone employer tax credit, and that's part of the Border Cities Enterprise Zone program. The maximum credit there is about $3,000. So that concludes sort of the income tax portion of the presentation.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, I will start with the sales tax section and cover just the revenue piece and the tax incident slide. Then Ms. Dalton will take care of the other sales tax slides.
Very good. And Mr. Williams, thank you.
On page 29 of your presentation, you can see sales taxes. Again, sales taxes is projected to raise $7 billion in fiscal year 2019. $795 million is taxes on motor vehicle sales and leases. And sales tax constitutes about 27% of total state taxes. Thank you. Businesses pay about 46% of the tax. And on slide 30, you have a 10-year history of sales tax revenues from fiscal 2009 to 2019. You can see in 2009, in nominal dollars, just short of $5 billion was collected. And in fiscal 2019, the projection is about $7 billion will be collected. Slide 31 shows, again, another tax incident slide. To follow up on Representative Joachim's question about the counts, the numbers in each decile, for each decile, there's 266, 91,000 households. And so for the decile, there would be 182,000 households. So for total households of 2.6 million. So as you can see, this again is an effective tax rate. The effective tax rates are the ratio of taxes paid per quintile relative to household income.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Ms. Templin. Can you tell me why in both the income tax chart and the sales tax chart you have, and this may be a, okay, so inflation adjusted dollars, the only difference in nominal dollars is roughly the same. We have a decreasing effect from 2009 to 2019. Is that based only on inflation? Are there any other factors there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, this is just inflation adjusted, not adjusted for anything else.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You good?
Okay.
Ms. Templin.
Back to the effective tax rates. You can on this slide, one of the things I wanted to point out is that this slide is kind of reverse of the income tax slide on effective tax rates. You can see in the first quintile that the households with the lowest income pay a larger share of their household income on sales taxes. And also on this slide, you can see the share that is paid by consumers and the share that's paid by businesses.
slide 32 of the presentation shows who pays the tax. And again, this is the ratio of taxes paid, the ratio of taxes paid by quintile relative to total sales taxes. And one of the things I wanted to point out here is you can see in the fifth quintile, they do pay that quintile of household incomes pays the largest share of the tax at 41.7%. But the other quintiles also are picking up a larger share of the tax, relative to the who pays tax for income taxes, where you saw the fifth quintile picking up like 75%, just in comparison to that. Again, all of the bars that you see for the first through the fifth quintile should equal 100%. And that is sales. That is just a quick overview of the incidence of sales tax and the revenues.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Pat Dalton. First thing I'm going to talk about is where do sales tax revenues go? Most of the revenues go to the general fund, but there are a number of dedications of sales tax revenue, and these have been increasing. Motor vehicle sales tax, which is set at 6.5%, has been dedicated to transportation funding since 2006, and that's a constitutional dedication. Taxes on motor vehicle leases were first dedicated to transportation funding beginning in 2008, and all but $32 million of that was dedicated, but as of right now, all of it is dedicated. Motor vehicle leases are not subject to the motor vehicle sales tax. They're actually subject to the general sales tax, so that's why they're two parts. We also have not only the regular general sales tax on short-term rentals, when you rent a car at the airport, but we also have some additional taxes on that. We have a 9.2% tax on that plus a, and that plus the general tax is also dedicated. That dedication started, I want to say, in 2013, and that's about $70 million. The most recent one is a dedication that went into effect, I believe, in 2013 as well. Well, I'm looking at Cynthia to see if she agrees with me. That one actually went into effect in 2017. It's a tax on auto parts. And that one's a little interesting because we don't really have a good estimate of how much sales tax revenue is raised by auto parts. So what was put in was a proxy for that. That proxy is $31 million a year right now, but is scheduled in statute to go up to $145 million beginning in fiscal year 2020. There's a small dedication of tax on fireworks if we were going to expand the definition of fireworks. Unfortunately, the dedication got passed, but the expansion of legal fireworks didn't. So there's virtually nothing in that one. For a long time, we have had a dedication on general aviation aircraft parts. About 75% of the in lieu of sales
Ms. Dalton,
tax.
So you're saying we have a tax there just ready to explode? Please continue.
75% of the roughly $100 million in lottery in lieu payments are dedicated to various numbers of things, primarily natural resources, and revenue from the legacy amendment, which is the extra 0.375% sales tax, which we'll talk about on the next slide, is also dedicated. So, the legacy amendment.
Ms. Dalton. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, just regarding the sales tax on rented vehicles, I believe there was a bill I co-authored or was contemplating authoring repealing one of those taxes. Can you remind the committee why there's a double tax on that and how that started and what the benefit is on a double tax on renting vehicles. Now, albeit it's usually out-of-towners, but not necessarily true. That's kind of the justification. Well, it's out-of-towners, so we don't care about them. But there are many Minnesotans that have to rent a car, and they're double taxed on it. So that is my question.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the extra tax on short-term motor vehicle rentals actually went back in, I want to say, back in the 90s during a budget crisis. It was originally a flat tax of $8 or $9 per rental, and then it went to a percentage tax when they needed a little bit more money. There is actually a third tax or fee on short-term motor vehicle rentals as well. That one is 5%. That one's a little different, however, because the owners of the rental vehicle are allowed to keep the revenues from that fee up to the amount that they pay for motor vehicle registration tax on those rental vehicles, and then anything in excess of that that they collect actually also goes to the state, but that's a pretty small amount. But what this means is that the total sales tax on short-term motor vehicle rentals in this state is 21, a little over 21%, and yes, it's a very high rate. One of the other things that's kind of unique about this is it applies to car sharing as well. And one of the reasons car sharing has not taken off in this state is because that hourly car sharing rate meets our definition of a short-term rental. And so you're paying a 21% tax on that. And that is, somebody in New York did a study on tax rates on effective tax rates on short-term car rental of these car share, and we have the highest state highest tax in the nation.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, so something for the committee to think about, that since we're not in a budget deficit like they were in 1991, but a surplus projected, albeit, perhaps we could look at reducing that. Would the if the chair thinks that would be a good idea? Since car sharing, of course, is a good idea to share, right? It's less good for the environment and the climate and the congestion, et cetera, et cetera.
Representative McDonald, the chair would never prevent anyone from introducing a bill. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I think that the premise behind the short-term car rental is don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. And there was a perception that a lot of the tax was paid by out-of-state residents, out-of-state visitors into the state.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Representative McDonald.
So with that said, Ms. Dalton, do we have a percentage of the in-state that pays that particular 21%?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't know what it is, but I have a feeling that if we really needed to look at it, the Department of Revenue could come up with an estimate.
Right. We will see if we can get that information. Thank you for bringing that up.
I'll introduce the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Very good. Ms. Dalton.
I just rented a car yesterday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let's talk about the legacy amendment. In 2009, our general sales tax rate went from 6.5% to 6.875%. That 0.375% was a constitutionally voted on increase in our sales tax, and it is constitutionally dedicated. That extra rate is in place for 25 years. And the revenue, which is about $335 million this year, is divided roughly 33% into the Outdoor Heritage Fund, 33% to the Clean Water Fund, and the remaining 35% to Parks and Trails and Arts and Cultural Heritage. And those cannot really be played with. Those are actually in the Constitution. We've kind of covered a lot of stuff on this slide. General rate, as I said, is 6.875%. We do have, as I said, a combined rate of 21.075% on short-term motor vehicle rentals.
manufactured housing and park trailers have an interesting sales tax. It's the 6.875%, but it's on 65% of the cost. And the rationale behind that is that we tax construction materials used for housing, but we don't tax the labor used in building houses. And when you build new houses, it was roughly 65% was materials, 35% was labor. So this was to try to get manufactured housing on the same kind of tax basis as other more conventional housing. And then last, the motor vehicle sales tax rate on motor vehicle sales is only 6.5%. The constitutional tax did not apply to taxes in, they only applied to taxes in Chapter 297A, the general sales tax, and motor vehicle sales tax is in a separate chapter, it's 297B. What is our tax base? You may want to look at page 31 of this big handout. It has a much more detailed, starts a much more detailed discussion of it. But generally, our sales tax was imposed, I want to say back in 1967, back at a time when mainly we were a consumer economy of goods as opposed to services. And so goods are taxable unless specifically exempted. And generally speaking, services and intangible goods, all the stuff that we now do on the internet, are not taxable unless explicitly included in the law. So our tax base is goods and only the services and intangibles that we specifically list. Some of the examples of services and intangibles are, we have always taxed lodging. In 1987, we added a number of taxable services, cleaning services, security services, lawn care, pet boarding. We don't tax haircuts. the most recent addition
was... Excuse me, Ms. Stalton, we have a question. Representative Sinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I was a little ahead of you on your slide, but digital downloads, what's the revenue brought in by that?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, we would have to check. I can't even remember about what it was supposed to be. But essentially, the digital downloads that we are taxing are what are taxed when they their physical form is taxed. So we tax books. So e-books are taxed. We would tax if you bought a DVD. Nobody buys DVDs anymore. Everyone downloads. All right, a few people do. If we tax DVDs, so now we tax downloadable movies. So it's if it was, you know, if you bought photos from a photographer, and I'm looking at Representative McDonald, that would be taxable. So if you now have a photographer take pictures of you and he gives you, you know, he has the pictures on the cloud and you can access them from the cloud, that would be a taxable digital download.
Thank you. Representative Slinsky, did that answer your question? Representative O'Neill, and before you ask your question,
yes,
if you would just please introduce yourself and where you're from, because we did that earlier, so, and then ask your question.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt, Chair Marquardt. Well, I apologize, I was late. I'm somehow on two committees at one time. I'm not sure how that's going to work, but I'm also on the Corrections Committee, which meets on Wednesday, so I apologize for being late. I may or may not be here on Wednesdays here, but I am, so I serve District 29B, and that's Buffalo, Monticello, and Maple Lake. In my prior life, I worked at a CPA firm, and I helped businesses go through sales tax audits. Yes, not fun. So in that work, I discovered that, you had said lawn care, which kind of prompted my question. So as I'm helping this lawn care business go through a sales tax audit, I found it very curious that it is so complicated for that particular line of work to figure out if something is a service taxable or not. And one example is if they cut a tree down and if they hauled it away, those are two separate services. One is taxed and one is not. It is that strange. If they plant a tree or if they come back and trim the tree, those are some, that one is taxable, one is not. So I would recommend to the, you know, just something that we could look at, that in that particular line of work, it is horribly complicated for that poor little businessman to figure out what's taxable and what is not. So maybe the committee can take a look at that particular area of sales tax and maybe clean it up a bit, because it is really onerous.
Representative O'Neill, thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to that point, actually that is one of the real issues with sales tax exemptions. Anytime we don't tax all of consumption, we are going to be drawing lines. And the committee is going to decide where those lines are drawn. And every time you draw a line, I guarantee somebody will find it either complicating or unfair. When we start talking a little bit about the exemptions, I can give you a few examples of that. But that is literally what I spend most of my time helping you draft legislation, is where should those lines be drawn, and can we simplify those lines to make it easier for businesses to comply with our sales tax law.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about, you're talking about digital downloads, how about hard durable goods? I go on Amazon, buy some things, they're delivered to my home. Are those taxed by the state?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lean, as of October 1, 2018, they are, and we will talk about that a few slides down.
Actually, Ms. Dalton, you have three slides on major exemptions. Before we get to the Wayfair decision, that's where we're going to take the break. So, because we only have about 9 minutes left. So we won't quite get there today, but they'll bring back people tomorrow. that one. So, Ms. Dalton, if we'll go through, I think we've got three more slides before we get the sales tax and remote sales, and that's going to be a break point for today. So,
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to Representative Switzinski's question about digital downloads. I just looked it up in 2013 when the legislation was passed to tax digital downloads. The spreadsheet showed that it raised about $5 million a year.
Very good. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I would also add that we had some debate over whether that was actually the amount, because one of the issues was who was making the downloads. One of the big issues was we already had iTunes actually was already paying sales tax. But there were a number of other services that, because Apple has a presence in this state, they have all their Apple stores, but a number of other services weren't, and how you divided those services ended up being kind of controversial about that number.
Representative Swazinski.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'll continue this. So depending on what, so if it was existing, so like you wouldn't consider a digital download of a book in that amount? Is that what you're kind of saying?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, prior to taxing digital downloads, we were already taxing canned computer software. And the question becomes, what is canned, and this is where we get again into line drawing. What is canned computer software and what is a digital download? Video games are often canned computer software. They were already taxable prior to us explicitly listing them as video games being a digital download. So some things are taxable under two different definitions, and that's why that revenue estimate is kind of a little tricky.
Okay. I'll quit.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, just so I understand, too, when we talk about finite goods, so downloads, let's say in books, can be two different things. You can get one from the library and download it, and it disappears after 3 weeks. But then if you purchase the download or if you have it permanently, is there a difference there on how it's taxed? If it goes away, it's not. And if it's permanent, it is, if you own it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, actually what's the difference there is not whether it's permanent or non-permanent. If you lease a digital download, if you have access to a movie through Amazon for 48 hours or 2 weeks, that's still taxable. However, if there's no cost, if the library isn't charging you for your download, then there's no sales tax.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, I'm just looking on the Minnesota Department of Revenue fact sheet number 177 regarding non-taxable digital products, and it does say that charts and graphs, digital photos, obviously I'm concerned about that, and drawings, and then logos and designs. So what's the discrepancy there? If it says non-taxable digital products, and then it lists those three that I mentioned, is it? So I should stop there.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I would have to actually go back and take a look at it. I'm not quite sure where we draw all the lines in the digital downloads off the top of my head. We sometimes joke about we play stump the analyst in this committee, and I feel like we have had our first. Well, I think Representative McDonald has managed to win at this point. I would have to go back and look.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I didn't mean to stump you, but from what Ms. Dalton and I worked on this a lot, and it depends on most people. Have you downloaded a photograph before? So if you have, it depends on what you do with it. If you're going to hang it in the hallway at a business, then it's taxable. If you're going to display it on your screen, it's non-taxable. If you're going to blow it up and throw darts at it, it's taxable. So it's a very difficult and complicated as to what you do with that image. But to be continued.
Yes. And so, Ms. Dalton, I think if we could finish the exemptions, and then we will break for the day.
Mr. Chair, let's go back up to the 10,000 level, foot level. There are a number of major exemptions for individuals, which we are all very familiar with. We do not tax food for home consumption. We do not tax clothing. We do not tax home heating fuels. Motor fuels, which are subject to the gas tax, are not subject to the sales tax. All drugs for human consumption, your drugs for your pets are still taxable. Newspapers and subscription magazines are not taxable, and cigarettes are not subject to the sales tax because they are subject to a separate in lieu tax instead. We have a history of essentially trying not to tax business inputs. It's hard to believe that, given that 43% of our, or 46% of our tax is actually paid by businesses. The reason generally we don't is because any sales tax paid by business essentially gets built into the cost that the business charges its consumers, and so it becomes a double taxation or a tax pyramiding issue. We exempt capital equipment. We exempt most farm machinery. We exempt most direct inputs to agriculture and industrial productions. In 1997, we provided an exemption for certain inputs for taxable services that hadn't existed before. And the most recent is we now have an exemption for purchases by qualified data centers. And I'm not even going to go into that one. The other thing is we have a number of entity exemptions. We are by law not allowed to tax most sales to the federal government. We have just recently removed the sales tax to most local governments. However, state government continues to pay tax on their purchases. Again, this was a budget issue. We don't tax sales to a number of nonprofit, charitable, religious, educational, and youth organizations. We have a whole section in the sales tax law about what is meant by nonprofit, charitable, religious, educational, and youth organizations, and they are listed in more detail in that larger handout. We also don't tax certain sales by nonprofit, charitable organizations. We don't tax sales related to short-term fundraising by a lot of nonprofits. There's a $10,000 annual sale exemption for sales made by youth groups, so the Boy Scouts can go out and sell their wreaths, and you know the campfire girls can now sell their candy. We don't tax YMCA, YWCA, JCC, memberships, and we don't tax charity golf events. And I will stop there.
Well, members, thank you for your questions. Staff, thank you so much for your presentation. We will meet at 8 a.m. tomorrow. And with that, the committee.